That's if you miss me from the back of the bus. Many of us hear bus boycotts and think of Rosa Parks as just a tired old woman who rather accidentally one day refused to give up her seat in the white section of the segregated bus. But the facts suggest she was a professional activist following a specific plan. What else don't we know about women of the civil rights movement? I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. When we think of the civil rights movement, we think of Martin Luther King Jr. Why have so few of us heard of crucially important women activists such as Ella Baker and Diane Nash? How did singers like Fannie Lou Hamer play a vital role in the movement? Joining me to explore women of the civil rights movement is Craig Werner, chair of the Afro-American Studies Department at the UW-Madison and author of numerous books, including A Change is Gonna Come, Music, Race, and the Soul of America, Higher Ground, Stevie Wonder, Aretha Franklin, Curtis Mayfield, and the Rise and Fall of American Soul, and the recent Love and Happiness, Eros According to Dante, Shakespeare, Jane Austen, and the Reverend Al Green. Also here and there throughout this hour, we'll be hearing the words of women of the civil rights movement read by Sagacious Levingston. Sagacious is a doctoral candidate in the Department of English, as well as an instructor through the UW Writing Center and Odyssey Project. Welcome back to University of the Air.
Happy to be here.
So why should we know about women of the civil rights movement? What do we miss out if we only hear sort of the conventional narrative?
Simple answer is the truth.
The movement
was publicly headed by Dr. King and a variety of other leaders, almost all of them male. But the work that created real change in the conditions of life for African Americans in the United States came largely out of organizations, organizing energies in the community that were led by women from the very beginning.
Well, let's start with Rosa Parks because she is this icon of the movement. There's, you know, a photo of her sitting on the bus. And I think most of us do have a sort of image of her as just one day having been fed up and just tired and she didn't give up her seat.
The tired old seamstress whose feet sparked the movement. The fact is Rosa Parks had been involved with civil rights before it was called the civil rights movement. The African-American freedom movement goes back to the beginning of black people's presence in the Western Hemisphere. But she'd been an activist working on issues primarily of sexual violence for well over a decade before she made that decision not to surrender her seat on the bus in Montgomery.
Working as a volunteer?
She was both a volunteer and a paid activist. She'd worked and worked throughout her life for different organizations. But she came to prominence in 1944 over a case of sexual violence against a woman named Reachie Taylor in Abbeville, Alabama. And Rosa Parks had been sent out as an investigator to see what had happened, to interview people, to dig up the truth of the case. And she had continued to be involved with that issue from the beginning. So one of the reasons that's important to focus on women in the movement is that although kind of the standard narrative of the movement says it was about legal rights, it was about passing laws, it was about getting unjust procedures, processes removed. From the perspective of the African-American community, one of the most important issues, I would say the most important issue, was stopping sexual violence against black women who worked as domestics largely.
Well, I guess I have to ask, why then do we have the wrong idea of Rosa Parks? Was it deliberately presented that she was just a tired old seamstress, or how did that misconception come about?
Rosa Parks was a very useful symbol, and she understood her role as a symbol in the Montgomery bus boycott. She was not the first woman in Montgomery to have refused to give up her seat on the bus. There's a young woman, Claudette Colvin, who shortly before Rosa Parks sparked the movement, her famous action, had done something very, very similar. But Claudette Colvin was not a good symbol for the movement. She was dark-skinned, was part of it, and Rosa Parks was light-skinned, and that mattered at the time. She came from a lower-class background. She was a very good student, but she was pregnant at the time, and so the movement was well aware that they couldn't put her out front because she would be attacked. Rosa Parks was the last word and respectable. She looked good. She was articulate, and she accepted the role that she was given in the movement, to serve as the face of the movement, really.
So she was kind of planted on the bus that
She day? Was not planted on the bus. It was a choice that she made on the spur of the moment, but not unthinkingly. She was well aware of the situation with segregation on the buses. She was well aware that the local activists were looking for a test case, and she simply decided that her moment had come. And she said,
"People always say that I didn't give up my seat because I was tired, but that isn't true. I was not tired physically, or no more tired than I usually was at the end of a working day. I was not old, although some people have an image of me as being old then. I was 42. No, the only tired I was tired of giving in."
And she knew she'd be arrested?
She knew she would be arrested. The bus driver whose bus she was on was notorious for his mistreatment of the African-American community. So, yes, she knew what was coming.
And what gave her the courage, in your opinion? I mean, you look at all these people who came out of the same circumstances, and there seem to be some people who have that, I don't know what it is, mm-hmm. that gives them the strength to get arrested, to get beaten, to get clobbered. And for Rosa Parks, where was that core coming from?
It went back to her childhood, that she grew up in a household where her grandfather told her stories and where she experienced the reality of white supremacist violence in the community around her all the time. And she simply was aware of that world. And then beyond that, I think it's almost mystery what it gives one individual mm-hmm. the right to do that. But from the very beginning, she knew that she was tired of what was happening around her. And she also took her strength from her knowledge that she wasn't alone. She knew that she was part of a community that represented many, many other people. That's another one of the important things about black women in the movement, is that they had done the hard work in the churches, and just the things that women always do, you know, taking care of the day-by-day details. The men got the publicity, the women did the work, mm-hmm. and Rosa Parks came directly out of that tradition.
What were some of the racist incidents that she had witnessed and experienced prior to the bus incident?
The standard ones from kind of African-American history, the Klan rode at night. She was aware that they were intimidating the black community. If anybody had the temerity to attempt to register to vote or simply not to accept their place, it was hooded violence against the black community, part of the world she grew up in.
And what was the immediate effect of Rosa Parks resisting?
Well, what happened in Montgomery was that largely because of the organizing work of a woman named Joanne Robinson, who was a teacher at Alabama State College, they were ready to swing into high gear when they had the right moment to do it.
And remind me of the date again. She refuses to give up her seat when?
This is 1956 that she refuses to stand. And at that point, the organization began to do something it knew it was going to do, that they were going to call a bus boycott against the bus company, which was entirely dependent upon black ridership to stay financially solvent. There had been previous bus boycott in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, which was a model for what happened in Montgomery. It didn't become the spark that Montgomery did, but people were aware of it in Montgomery. And so Joanne Robinson and the women of the movement mimeographed thousands of flyers asking people in the black community not to ride the bus the next day, to stand up for it. So long before Martin Luther King knew anything was happening, the bus boycott was in motion.
And I've never heard of Joanne Robinson. Why is that?
Well, part of it is because as soon as the boycott took off and it was clear that it had been effective, the local activists, the NAACP, swung into motion to support it. And I don't want to say that Dr. King was not important. He was important. He was particularly important in Montgomery because there were many different local leaders who would have wanted the publicity, kind of, and wanted the attention. King was new on the scene, and so he wasn't polarizing figure. And, of course, he was an amazing orator. But the movement decided to put Dr. King out front. That was a conscious decision. And when there were a number of meetings at which people talked about the movement, and Rosa Parks and Joanne Robinson did not speak at those meetings. It was the males speaking. That has a lot to do with the fact that the American media at the time was not going to take a woman seriously as a spokesman.
And were these women aware of that sexism at the time? I mean, or did they, in other words, let's say it's Joanne Robinson. Is she aware that she's sort of getting covered over, that nobody's really aware of her presence as much as they are of the men out front?
Certainly, she's aware of it. But most of the women who were involved with it accepted their role as part of the larger struggle. In retrospect, many of them were quite critical of the dynamics there. But they generally didn't say it should have been different then. It was really the only way it could be. And when you win the struggle, you win the struggle.
And how did the bus boycott actually work then? In other words, on an economic level, what happened?
The black women did not ride the buses, which meant that they brought the bus company to its knees. They organized carpools to drive people to their jobs, mostly as domestics. And the white community was dependent on that labor. They needed cheap labor to afford their houses, to afford their country club memberships, things like that. So they couldn't just fire the maids. That wasn't going to work. But the city fathers of Montgomery put pressure on it. They gave out tickets for running unauthorized taxi services, things like that. The African-American community in Chicago, amongst other places, sent cars down there to support the movement. They raised money and sent the cars to Montgomery, which is another part of the movement that's generally not known, that it was integrated. And those were African-American labor organizations. So it was a concentrated effort, and the hard part was holding the community together over that. There was huge pressure on individuals in the community, black people, to go along with the boycott. You needed the unity. You couldn't fragment. You couldn't splinter. And they held together.
We opened the program with a little bit of the song, If You Miss Me, from the Back of the Bus, and you could hear this whole group of singers in that. It was a very communal kind of song. And I'm curious what kinds of techniques were used to make people feel part of a movement rather than just individuals.
I think that the key to that was that people needed to feel that they were not an isolated I, that they were part of a bigger we. Rosa Parks spoke to that.
Whatever my individual desires were to be free, I was not alone. There were many others who felt the same way.
And that's the spirit that sounds in the music. That it was the music that allowed people to hold together, to stand up and say, okay, it's not just my voice, it's our voices. And as you heard on that first cut, the voices are not singing really in unison. They're each singing with their own spirit, their own way of getting through things. And you hear that also in this cut, which is called We Shall Not Be Moved.
In the end,
Hear the sound of women as sort of foot soldiers, almost like an army that's saying we won't be moved, we're going to resist. How important was the victory in Montgomery?
Yeah, well, you hear them saying we're on our way to victory, mm-hmm. and segregation is the enemy. It must be removed. Montgomery was incredibly important because it gave the movement a victory, really, a inspiration that says we can make a difference. Ordinary people can make a difference. Women can make a difference. And the ordinary people who made the biggest difference in Montgomery were clearly the women there. It also was important for establishing Dr. King as a leader. And again, this was part of where we lose part of the real story. The Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the organization that King led coming out of Montgomery, put out a comic book, which is really amusing, that shows Martin Luther King with his sleeves rolled up, running the mimeograph machine to announce the boycott. At that point, King didn't even know there was a movement, let alone run off the mimeographs himself. There's no way a preacher was doing that at the time. But it was very important to have that charismatic figure who could spread the news from place to place, which is why the women didn't feel resentful of what had happened. But the real story of the civil rights movement immediately following Montgomery is the rise of massive resistance, the white resistance to civil rights. And we tend to forget in our simplified version of civil rights that it was a battle, and you have two sides in a battle. And between 1956 and 1960 or so, there's every reason to think that the white supremacists, that massive resistance, was winning. Brown versus Board of Education had been passed by the Supreme Court in 1954, and to a large extent, the White South said, well and good, you got your law, now make it stick. And that was really the next phase of the movement. And again, women played a key role in the renewal.
We're going to meet some of the women involved in sit-ins and freedom rides when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air.
Talk, 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 talk
That's Woke Up This Morning with My Mindset on Freedom with Bernice Johnson Reagan and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee Freedom Singers. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Professor Craig Werner, and we are talking about women of the civil rights movement. Tell us about that song to start us off with.
It's probably the classic from the most inspiring, I think, part of the movement in the early 1960s. The SNCC Freedom Singers, and that's the way they all said it, SNCC, consciously put music at the center of what they were doing, of holding ordinary people together. That SNCC was committed to a vision of community, the beloved community. That's a phrase used by Ella Baker, who was quite a bit older than the students with SNCC, but was a incredibly important person to making the movement what it was.
I've heard you say on other occasions that Ella Baker, in some ways, is more important than Martin Luther King to the movement, which seemed like a really extreme statement for someone that we don't have an Ella Baker Day. You know, we barely know about this figure. You know, what leads you to that seemingly hyperbolic statement?
I've also said that Ella Baker is the most important political figure of the 20th century in America, with the possible exception of Franklin Roosevelt, if you want to up the ante a little bit there. Ella Baker had a vision of political change that strikes me as much more realistic and meaningful than the kind of approach that says we will elect somebody and then they will pass laws and things will change. That's not the way the world works.
Sort of the great leader idea.
The great leader, the great man theory. And it almost always is a great man, not a great woman.
Yeah, I've noticed.
But what Ella Baker believed was that real change came in the way that we lived our lives every day. And she had a vision of how to make that happen and how to support it. One of the things that she said that I find most inspirational was this.
You didn't see me on television. You didn't see news stories about me. The kind of role that I tried to play was to pick up pieces or put together pieces out of which I hoped organization might come. My theory is strong people don't need strong leaders.
The organizing tradition, not the leadership tradition. Martin Luther King consciously put on television shows that he was publicizing the movement to people throughout the United States and putting on a very morally compelling drama of good versus evil. He was a preacher. He understood what was happening in just those kinds of terms. He didn't demonize the opposition. But what Ella Baker understood was that after the TV cameras left, people in the small towns of the South, people in the cities of the South, were going to have to make this work every day. And she thought that that happened through organizing the energies of the community of everyday people. It's democracy at its absolute finest.
And make her real to me. I mean, what was her background? Where did she come out of? And what led her to become this figure that you see as so pivotal?
Yeah, Ella Baker had grown up, again, in the Jim Crow era, as had Rosa Parks. She'd experienced the same kinds of things. And she had begun working actively with the NAACP, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, in the 1930s. And she was always, throughout her entire life, consciously focused on making freedom real. She was a tremendous recruiter for the NAACP. She went out and got people involved in the small communities. There was always a tendency to look at the leadership and say, well, those are the big people, those are the rich people, those are the preachers or the undertakers or the insurance salesmen, you know, the people who ran the black community in some ways, certainly in the eyes of white people, and say, well, it's not about ordinary people like me. And Ella Baker said, yeah, it is about ordinary people mm-hmm. like you. It's exactly about ordinary people like you.
And what were some of the things that Ella Baker spoke up about?
Well, she, from the beginning, worked with the NAACP to support their legal drive, because the NAACP was always focused on reforming the system, working through the courts particularly. It worked for a long time gathering the information that went into the court cases that led up to the Supreme Court case, Brown versus Board of Education. And Ella Baker was one of the people who organized the energies that allowed the evidence to be there when Thurgood Marshall, and again, we know Thurgood mm-hmm. Marshall, when he needed it, a lot of that evidence had arrived on his desk because of the efforts of Ella Baker. And then she, when Martin Luther King emerged as a leader, Ella Baker, recognizing the energy, was committed to that. And she worked with SCLC, King's organization.
That would be the Southern Christian Leadership.
Southern Christian Leadership Conference, yeah. And the irony here is that she was the acting executive secretary of SCLC. That means she was the person who made things work. That without Ella Baker, nothing would have happened in that organization. But the board of directors was not going to accept a woman as executive secretary. So she was
acting. That just a sort of understanding there'd be no woman, or was it actually a kind of policy?
It was not a formal policy. And there's evidence that King didn't much like it because he knew mm-hmm. how dependent he was on her efforts. But it was also not something that they were going to bend on. And unlike Rosa Parks and Joanne Robinson, Ella Baker was well aware and not happy with that situation. She knew she was not getting the respect, really, that she deserved for her efforts.
And she would have been something of an elder at that point?
Yeah, she was definitely an elder. She would have been in her 50s by that time. And when she became a crucial figure with the young activists in the early 60s, she was in her 60s. But the students absolutely embraced her.
And was she connected as well to the sort of the youth, you know, the schools, where was she recruiting people from?
Yeah. Well, she recruited people everywhere. She went into communities. But she was one of the people who worked with the Highlander Folk School in rural Tennessee, led by a white man, actually, Miles Horton, who provided a place to train activists, is what Highlander was about. It roots deep in the labor movement. The civil rights song, We Shall Overcome, was actually a labor song that began as I Shall Overcome, and it became We Shall Overcome at Highlander.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and Ella Baker worked with training activists there. She was part of the structure that set up the citizenship schools, which taught black people throughout the rural South to read and write. You had to pass a literacy test to vote at the time. So that was absolutely important. And again, another elder woman, Septima Clark, had been a teacher, and she took the lead role in putting the citizenship schools together. So again, you see this network of activists of many sorts, and Ella Baker always shows up. Again, it's a little hard at times to say exactly what she did because she didn't seek the publicity. She organized. She made networks. She got people together and made sure they followed through.
What kind of role did she play with the sit-ins?
Well, with the sit-ins was the most important, I would say, moment where that comes into the foreground, because the sit-ins had been started by students in Greensboro, and then they spread very, very rapidly. There were sit-ins all over the rural South, literally like wildfire. There had been sit-ins for a while before, but early 1960, they spread. And Ella Baker was fed up with the SCLC by then. She left the SCLC, criticizing the pulpit mentality of the male leaders there. And she committed herself to SNCC, and she organized a conference. It actually was the founding conference of SNCC. She committed herself to the students who had sparked the sit-ins. And she organized a conference at Shaw University in Raleigh, North Carolina, which was where SNCC assumed its organizational identity. And SNCC was committed to the idea of the beloved community, that we are all members of a community. And again, that goes back to Ella Baker.
And to nonviolence. That's the N in SNCC, right?
It is. The Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, following through on the vision of Dr. King, who had studied Gandhi and believed both tactically and philosophically that nonviolence was the best route for the movement. There were a lot of people in the movement who believed that nonviolence was the best way to move practically, who were not philosophically committed to it. But Ella Baker had a deep commitment to nonviolence, and she convinced the students in SNCC that that was the way to go. They were already in agreement with that, but she solidified that.
I think one of the most just appalling things about the civil rights movement when you watch it is the violence against nonviolent protesters, whether it's at the sit-ins or with the Freedom Rides or whatever it is. It's just to watch brutality being inflicted on people who are being nonviolent.
Absolutely. And one of the things they taught at Highlander was how to take that violence and how to protect yourself and how to not respond, because not responding was difficult. One of the most important of the younger activists that Ella Baker worked with was Diane Nash, who was at Fisk University in Nashville, which is one of the places that the sit-ins spread to. And Diane Nash, like Dr. King, had a profound commitment to nonviolence. She'd been in a philosophy class at Fisk, and she'd been introduced to the idea of agape, the Christian idea of the love of God, the all-encompassing love of God. And she spoke repeatedly about how it was her commitment to loving everybody, including your enemies. You love everybody unconditionally. Doesn't mean you don't stand up to them. You certainly stand up to them. But she took that part of the movement and, as a younger activist, placed it at the center.
And so what did Diane Nash do? If you take her out of the story, kind of what doesn't happen with
it's
the civil rights?
It's a very, very different story. For one thing, in Nashville, which was one of the most important of the sit-ins and victorious sit-ins, she was the organizer again. She was one of the people who just made sure that the marches were organized, that the flyers were out there. Really amusing moment is some guys on the football team at Fisk came to Diane Nash, and they said, we'd see what's going on. We'd like to support this. And she explained agapic love to her and to them and nonviolence. And they said, okay, so you're telling me is that when somebody hits me, I don't hit back? And she said, yeah, it's exactly what I'm telling you. And they said, we're not really going to do that. And so they put them to work running the mimeograph machines and working behind the scenes and stuffing envelopes. So you had the football team at Fisk playing its part, but playing a very unconventional male part there. Amazing moment in Nashville happened when Diane Nash confronted Ben West, the mayor of Nashville, kind of a Southern liberal, but still a segregationist at the time. And they were speaking on the steps of, I believe, a city hall. And she just asked him straightforward. She said, do you, as a man, not as the mayor, but as a man, believe that it is right to discriminate against somebody simply because of the color of their skin? And Ben West, who had been representing the segregationists, thought for a moment and he said, no, I don't. And it's an amazing moment where you get a public figure confronted with moral truth, the power of nonviolence, agapic love. Mm-hmm. And that was a very important moment in the movement, symbolically. But even more important was what Diane Nash did during the Freedom Rides. The Freedom Rides had started in Washington, D.C. Part of the Congress of Racial Equality Corps had been the group that put them in motion. And as they traveled south to desegregate the public buses, which was their legal right at the time, they were met by increasing violence. They burned a bus outside of Anniston, Alabama, very famous, horrifying images. It was a minor miracle that everybody in the bus wasn't killed because they firebombed it and the door didn't open to start with. They went on. They went on to Montgomery. They went to Birmingham. They were met by just intense violence. They were battered. They were beaten. They were hospitalized. And when the Freedom Riders got to Birmingham and they decided that they just didn't have the strength to go on, that they had put their lives on the line. And Diane Nash in Nashville heard that what was happening in Birmingham, and she said, we can't let this happen, that we have to continue with the Freedom Rides. And what she said was,
it was clear to me that if we allowed the Freedom Ride to stop at that point, just after so much violence had been inflicted, the message would have been sent that all you have to do to stop a nonviolent campaign is inflict massive violence.
And so she recruited, gathered up some of her fellow activists in Nashville, and they drove on down to Birmingham, and they said, we're moving on from here. We're going to take it into Mississippi. We're going to take it down to New Orleans, which is where it was originally intended to go. But she kept it moving. And Bull Connor, the sheriff of Birmingham, at one point, he'd imprisoned the Freedom Riders, and then he let them out, drove them to the Tennessee border and dumped them there. And as soon as they got to a place where they could do it, they got in a car and went right back to Birmingham. They damn near beat Bull Connor back to Birmingham after that. So she was just determined to keep on moving. And then the other thing that Diane Nash did was she and James Bevel, another activist who she was married to for a while, decided that it was time for a campaign in Alabama for voting rights. And so she and Bevel recruited what they called a nonviolent army to march into Alabama, and that became the core of the Selma campaign, a very, very famous campaign, which was met again by extreme violence when they tried to cross the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Martin Luther King turned back in the face of that violence at one point. But it was the violence in Selma that led to the passing of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. And that act was going nowhere until Selma. And so the campaign that Diane Nash was crucial to forming was absolutely central to getting one of the most important pieces of legislation in American history.
Ella Baker and Diane Nash sound like incredibly tenacious figures, and we're going to meet another tenacious figure, Fannie Lou Hamer, when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Thank you.
The soloist on that song, Wade in the Water, was Fannie Lou Hamer, singer and civil rights activist. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Craig Werner, and we're exploring women of the civil rights movement. Fannie Lou Hamer, we know her as a singer, but that side of her as an activist, I think, is less known.
Yeah, and it's really how she saw herself as an activist first, and she used the singing to support that. She's an amazing story. She was the youngest of 20 children who grew up on a plantation in Sunflower County, Mississippi, which for African Americans was about as close to the pit as you could get at that time. And she was not the kind of person you would expect to be a leader, but she was exactly the kind of person that Ella Baker was imagining, the kind of person who could galvanize a community. Her voice was a big part of that.
And how did she step into the story? We've talked about the bus boycotts, the sit-ins, the freedom rides. At what point does Fannie Lou Hamer sort of jump on board the civil rights story?
In 1962, she heard James Bevel, who was working with SNCC, the organization that Ella Baker had put together, give a sermon in Mississippi as part of organizing, trying to build the energies that ultimately led to Freedom Summer in 1964, dedicated to getting black people registered to vote in Mississippi. And Hamer thought that working with SNCC sounded a whole lot better than picking more cotton. And apparently she was a tremendous cotton picker, could pick hundreds of pounds of cotton in a day. But she signed on with SNCC, and in 1963, she went to a workshop in South Carolina, which was being conducted by Septima Clark, one of the people that Ella Baker had trained at Highlander. The networks are all over the place here. And on the way back, she and the people she was with were stopped by the police in Winona, Mississippi. And they were imprisoned, and they were brutalized, and they were kept incommunicado for several days. It was one of the most vicious attacks on activists in a movement which was filled with vicious attacks on activists. And she was already committed to the movement, but that didn't scare her off. That reinforced her determination to make a difference.
And the details that she describes of the brutality are really appalling.
Yeah, she testified before the Democratic National Credentials Committee at the 1964 convention in Atlantic City, and she described her beating.
I was carried out of that cell into another cell where they had two Negro prisoners. The state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro to take the blackjack. The first Negro prisoner ordered me, by orders from the state highway patrolman, for me to lay down on a bunk bed on my face. And I laid on my face. The first Negro began to beat me. And I was beat by the first Negro until he was exhausted. I was holding my hands behind me at that time on my left side because I suffered from polio when I was 6 years old. After the first Negro had beat until he was exhausted, the state highway patrolman ordered the second Negro to take the blackjack. The second Negro began to beat, and I began to work my feet. And the state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro who had beat to sit on my feet, to keep me from working my feet. I began to scream, and one white man got up and began to beat me in my head and tell me to hush. One white man, my dress had worked up high. He walked over and pulled my dress. I pulled my dress down, and he pulled my dress back up. All of this is on account of we want to register, to become first-class citizens. And if the Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now, I question America. Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave? Well, we have to sleep with our telephones off of the hooks because our lives be threatened daily, because we want to live as decent human beings in America.
Hearing that, it makes then, when you hear her voice singing, it's sort of just incredible, sort of the brutality that she overcame and then somehow was able to put into song as well.
And transforms it into determination. That Wade in the Water, the song goes way back to slavery with slaves trying to escape. And it was saying, wade in the water so the dogs can't follow you. You know, God's going to trouble that water. God's on your side in this ultimately. But obviously you had to survive all kinds of brutality. Some of it physical, but some of it institutional. Because the other thing that Fannie Lou Hamer did was commit herself to the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And that, in the summer of 1964, best known as Freedom Summer, when many activists, white and black, came to Mississippi to put together a voter registration campaign, were met again by violence, the murders of Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner. The movement decided that it was going to challenge the institutional racism of the Democratic Party in Mississippi. The Democratic Party in Mississippi was all white. And the Freedom Democratic Party said, this violates the procedures of the Democratic Party. We are going to set up a political party, and we are going to have a convention and elect delegates to send to Washington, D.C., and everybody is welcome to be here, black and white alike. And so they did it, and they put together a delegation for the Democratic National Committee, and this was an extreme embarrassment to the committee. And Fannie Lou Hamer was probably the central figure. She was the face of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, MFDP. And in Atlantic City, the Democratic leaders were scared to death of her.
Why?
Because Lyndon Johnson had put his prestige and his political power behind passing the Civil Rights Act in 1964. And he knew, he was a Southerner, he knew that this was not going to be popular and was going to be extremely unpopular in the South. So he had a political problem, and he didn't want to have it appear that he was being controlled by black people. He knew that that would lose the South to the Republicans, and it did. It lost the Deep South to the Republicans in 1964. But he was worried about the border states. He was worried about what would happen in his home state of Texas. He was worried about what would happen in North Carolina. He was worried about what would happen in Tennessee and Kentucky. And so he wanted the convention to go off as a show with no disruptions. And Fannie Lou Hamer and the MFDP were not going to accept that. They showed up. They said, we are the legitimate Democrats here. They said, we are loyal to you, by the way. And Democratic Convention asked the Southern delegates to pledge loyalty to the ticket. Mississippi delegation wouldn't do that. But it became very, very tense negotiations. And Johnson tried to, in essence, buy the MFDP off by offering them two at-large seats. It said, you can't be the Mississippi Convention, but you can come in here and you can observe. And the MFDP didn't want to do that. But Johnson sent Fannie Lou Hamer a delegation led by Hubert Humphrey, who ultimately was Johnson's vice president, but had not yet been identified as the candidate. And he sent Humphrey, who had a good civil rights record, to go try to convince Fannie Lou Hamer to take the deal. And Fannie Lou Hamer's response to Humphrey is deeply grounded in that tradition of agapic love, of nonviolence. She said to Humphrey, do you mean to tell me that your position is more important than 400,000 black people's lives? Senator Humphrey, I know lots of people in Mississippi who've lost their jobs trying to register to vote. I had to leave the plantation where I worked in Sunflower County, Mississippi. Now, if you lose the job of vice president because you do what is right, because you help the MFDP, everything will be all right. God will take care of you. But if you take the nomination this way, why, you will never be able to do any good for civil rights, for poor people, for peace, or any of those things you talk about. Senator Humphrey, I'm going to pray to Jesus for you. Reduced Humphrey to tears.
I think the common theme running through all the stories of women in the civil rights movement is that they were so outspoken and courageous and tireless, even though they didn't put their ego out there in the front of them.
I think that's a really good way to say it. It really was the power of love that they were working off of. The power of Jesus, all of them would have said it that way, one way or another, that it was deeply grounded in their Christian faith. And that was a faith that bound them to other people, to their community, and it was not ultimately about them as individuals. It was about black people as an oppressed people struggling for freedom, and all of them understood it was also about white people. It was about America. Fannie Lou Hamer says, is this America? She's asking us to be what we claim we are. You know, it's a great gospel song. Mahalia Jackson sung it often. I'm going to live the life they sing about in my song. That's what the women of the civil rights movement were asking us to do.
My guest has been Craig Werner, along with reader Sagacious Levingston. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you can join us for the next hour of University of the Year.
I'm going to stand for right and always showing the wrong. If I'm in a crowd, if I'm alone. In my song, every day, everywhere, on the busy thoroughfare, folks may watch me, folks may spot me, say I'm foolish, but I don't care. I can't go. Shout all day Sunday, go out and get drunk and rain. Set on a Monday, I'm gonna live the life I sing about in my song. Not for gold, no, nor for fame, but for the love of Jesus' name. I must always walk the straight, straight and narrow way. Jesus told me in that day he will wash all my sins away. Hey, gonna live the life I sing about. I sing about in my song. Oh yeah, I'm gonna stand right and always showing the wrong. If I'm in a crowd, if I'm alone, well on the street in my home. I sing about, oh, in my song.